This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Public access to some of this country's leading research libraries will now be just a click away and free thanks to Google. The world's most popular internet search engine announced yesterday that it has reached an agreement that would allow Google to digitize much of the research library collections at Stanford University, University of Michigan, Harvard University, and the Bodleian Library at Oxford University in England. The books and documents then would be available on the net. While significant, Google's move is just the latest in a larger effort to create a global virtual library. But the question is, what's in the virtual library and what's not? Will you use the virtual library and how will you access it? Join the conversation. Our number 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. Michael Keller joins us now by phone from Beijing in China. He is university librarian and director of academic information resources at Stanford University. He helped craft an agreement that will make nearly all of the 8 million books in the Stanford collection available on the net. Thanks for waking up so early to talk with us. I understand it's pretty early in the morning there now.
Yeah, thanks, Lynn. Actually, I'm in Shanghai, but it's the same time zone.
It's early there as well, I know. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about how does this agreement work exactly, this agreement with Google?
Well, in truth, what we have specified in the agreement is not any specific number of books. It's unclear on that matter. What we're going to do, however, is start with a very large tranche of books that we are sure are either out of copyright or reasonably sure are out of copyright. And for those books that happen to be in copyright as they go through the process, Google's going to display only snippets or meta information about the books. We think there may be as many as 2 million books in that first tranche. Then as we go along, we'll evaluate what's going on and see what the results are. And we'll also see what the attitude is of the publishers and intellectual property rights holders, because we really don't want to violate their rights. We think that authors and publishers are really very, very important, and we don't want to, you know, mess up with them.
So ultimately,
it could be 8 million volumes, but much depends upon, other events that come along in the course of the next years.
So this is still a work in progress, you're saying, still being developed?
Oh, yes. I think that just like building a library is always a work in progress, building a digital library is very much a work in progress.
What is Google doing to make this happen, and then what do the libraries have to do?
Well, I think Google's role in this has been seminal. First of all, Larry and Sergey have had this brilliant notion of using indexing, internet indexing, to make information available very widely for all sorts of purposes, all kinds of people. Then as we talked, and by the way, these conversations, I can remember talking with Sergey about this Larry about this in a meeting maybe 3 or 4 years ago. He was talking about getting the contents of our Highwire Press articles, basically academic science and social science articles, indexed and up and available through Google. So they have been really prime movers in this for a long time. What they will do is take our books and scan them. I think they'll do that for everyone else's books, and then index them and make the indexing available so that when you perform a search on Google, if you get a hit on a book, you'll then see either a page or information from the page or information about the page relating to that hit.
And does this change the nature of libraries?
Well, in a sense, it extends what's already been going on. Really, for the last 20 or 30 years, we've been dealing more and more with digital information. And much of that, however, has not been accessible through what became the web. It was always available through proprietary interfaces. Now what's happening is the acceleration of information becoming digitally available and available through the web. And Google is brilliant, absolutely brilliant, about providing access to publicly accessible information. And this information that's being derived from these books will become, in effect, public information. It does change the nature of libraries, but it doesn't do away with libraries. We will continue to select. we will continue to provide intellectual access, although Google is very much the huge part of the picture now. And we will continue to provide reference and interpretation services. We'll continue to distribute access to works that are either publicly available or proprietary. And we'll continue, I hope, to figure out how to preserve both physical books and digital information resources.
What about other search engines? Will you be making your collection available to other search engines as well as Google?
In principle, that is very much possible. And I have every expectation that some of the other search engines will come to us. However, the agreement with Google, you can imagine, because of the huge investment of time and money, and especially engineering smarts, would preclude us from taking the products of the Google effort and giving them away.
Let's take a call now, and if you'd like to join our discussion, I want to remind our listeners that the number is 800-989-8255, and we're going to go to Brad in Boise, Idaho. Hi, Brad.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
I am a copyright lawyer, and it intrigues me. This whole project intrigues me greatly, and the gentleman who's speaking, forgive me, I've forgotten his name, his comment about they'll begin with volumes for which they believe are either copyright-free or reasonably sure that they're copyright-free. As you know, determining the copyright status of a work can be very, very involved. I'm just curious, how do they intend to go about determining the copyright status of these works?
Michael Keller?
Okay, so the quick answer to that question is that there's no quick answer. You know very, very well. Certainly for books published in America before 1920, with imprint dates of 1922 and prior, the vast majority of those books are out of copyright. For books published between 1923 and 68, there's a very complicated kind of flowchart of questions that need to be asked and answered in order to determine whether a book has been re-registered.
Yes.
And in any case, I think the nubbin of the thing is whether the copying itself is in violation if we're not infringing with the marketplace for the books. And for the vast majority of these books are completely out of print, of course, and for many of them, the publishers and the authors have gone to their end. I think it is an excellent question. It's something that both the Google and I know all the libraries are quite concerned with.
All right. Thanks so much for your question, Brad.
Thank you.
What are some of the other challenges to this, apart from the copyright issues? I mean, what are some of the technological challenges just to digitizing all these books?
Well, as you can imagine, these books are in various sizes, and the typefaces are various sizes, and the graphics are various sizes and qualities. There are halftones, there are line cuts, there are all manner of colored illustrations. So one of the big issues, of course, is capturing the pages at high enough resolution to get the text into such a form as they can be indexed. So that's a big issue. Another big issue is doing it fast enough and efficiently enough.
Mm.
We at Stanford have been involved in digitization. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. There was some interference there on your phone, but go ahead.
Okay, so we at Stanford and at the other libraries have been involved in digitization for some while using various techniques. We, for instance, have a book scanning robot manufactured in Switzerland that we've been testing and using. And we know that our throughput, at best, with the most advanced machinery we have, would be on the order of 15,000 to 45,000 books a year. With a collection of 8 million books, you can see that we'd be digitizing for a very long time if we decided to try to digitize everything.
And go ahead.
Excuse me?
I wanted to read an email to you, which also raises some challenges to this coming from a librarian. And the question is, most books being digitized in the recently announced project will probably be written in English. I was wondering about online books in other languages and scripts. How will Google allow users to search online texts that are in or contain written material in other writing systems, such as the Indic scripts or even Egyptian hieroglyphs?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think we should expect that the works will not just be in English. There will be works in all the languages, but especially the indexing will take place in the European languages and the Roman character languages. I know that Google has prowess in Asian languages. I'm in China now, and I can see that their website here features kanji, and they can search in kanji. So they figured out how to index in kanji. I was recently at the Bibliotheca Alexandrina in Egypt, And I know that they're able to scan and OCR Arabic character languages. So my guess is that there are actually tools out there that will enable them to do the indexing and to allow folks to search in those characters and get results.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us, Michael Keller.
You're sure welcome.
Michael Keller is University Librarian and Director of Academic Information Resources at Stanford University. He joined us by phone from Shanghai in China. Joining us now is Brewster Kahle from member station KALW in San Francisco. He's founder of the Internet Archive, a nonprofit digital library, and he's been working to get greater access to the public domain. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit more about the Internet Archive. What's in it?
The Internet Archive is a nonprofit library that works with libraries to basically house and make available very publicly huge collections of books, music, video, also web pages that have been collected over the years. We have 40 billion of them, to give as universal access as we can and try to achieve universal access to, well, everything.
How do you access it?
So one goes to the website and is able to download and search and see these materials. We also can see them through all sorts of other interfaces. So, for instance, Democracy Now!, which is a radio program on NPR, uses our machines sort of as a host. So if you go to their website, you're actually using our collections, and you'll see this all over the web. We're in hundreds, thousands of websites sort of embedded in places to add value and content to the open world.
Can you get to it through Google?
Yes, Google and Yahoo actively crawl our websites and make our movies and music available. So we have 200,000 freely downloadable songs from 700 rock groups and 3,000 different internet-era music groups. So all of these materials are available and searchable through the public search engines.
Now, Google's been getting a lot of attention for these deals that it's made with these libraries, but this is not unprecedented. I mean, this kind of thing has been going on for a while, and perhaps in a smaller degree.
Yes, there have been digitization efforts that have been done, spearheaded in the public sphere by the libraries themselves. But Google's pronouncement and activity in this is going to reshape the library world. So yes, there have been work being done. For instance, the Million Books Project, which is a joint project between the United States, Carnegie Mellon, Internet Archive, as well as the government of India and government of China, to digitize 1 million books in each of India and in China for free public access, so it would be available to all without commercial restriction.
We've been talking a lot about what's going to be in the virtual library, what's in it already, but what's not there yet, and what's not likely to ever be there, or is everything going to get there eventually?
Currently, the vast majority of our libraries are not accessible over the Internet, which is a real tragedy in the sense that lots of people, students these days, I'd say myself, we use the Internet as the information resource of primary resort, and we often don't go the extra mile to go back to the libraries to find the extra copies. We make do. And this is a tragedy in the sense that the best that humankind has to offer is not on the net yet. But these steps to go and do large-scale digitization and make it available over the net, it will be a boon to access. It'll be fantastic. We just have to make sure we do it with the right blending of commercial and public interest involved.
We're talking with Brewster Kahle. He's the founder of the Internet Archive, and we're talking about how the virtual library just got a little bit bigger thanks to Google and other efforts to get books and documents digitized and on the net. What would you do if you had access to the library of some of the top universities in the countries, and if it was just a click away? We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking about the virtual library, what's in it and what's not. Our guest is Brewster Kahle, founder of the Internet Archive. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Let me ask you, Brewster, how will this move by mm-hmm. Google affect other search engines like Yahoo or MSN?
Well, it's going to massively raise the bar. Everybody's going to try to figure out how do they deal with this. If Google really is the place that people are going to go to for not only access to current information but the past information, then if you're going to try to compete with Google, you're going to try to figure out what's your place in this. This is not; these discussions are not just going on in the competitors to Google, but also in libraries. So what's the response? How do we deal with the with having a commercial player play such a strong role in a way in an information sphere that's always been basically in the public sphere before?
And do these other the search services have the kind of money that Google has? I mean, Google's putting investing a lot of money into this.
Well, let's take a look at some of the economics of it. If one were to digitize a book, the question is sort of how much does it cost? And you can spend up to $1 a page to do it, but there are other techniques to get it down to around 5 cents and even 3 cents a page. There are a 300-page book then would cost about $10 to digitize. So if we're talking about digitizing 1 million books, that's $10 million. Or as they announced, 15 million books, that's $150 million. That's a huge amount of money mm-hmm. By in some ways looking at it. But if you look at it in a broader social sphere, that's not that large a number. The United States spends $12 billion each year on its public library system. And so digitizing 15 million books is a small number of percentage points for 1 year to do to have this kind of digitization effort. What is interesting is Google is taking that step to boldly go and start digitizing, and they should be commended for that.
What about the dangers of scanning but damaging some books, rare documents, for example? Is there a danger in that?
Oh, absolutely. Some of these books and often old newspapers, you're only going to get one shot at it. So a lot of these are unique materials that if you open it, you're probably going to be the last time that you're going to be able to see it in that state.
Really?
So we want to do as good a scanning job as we can and also reuse those materials so we don't have to think that we've got to go back and redo it. So Yahoo doesn't have to go and try to round up a universities themselves, or Microsoft would have to go and round up their own universities. The idea is if we can get some cooperation around the public domain, I think we would all benefit.
How does the scanning process work exactly? Can you describe it?
Yes, the non-destructive scanning, so there's destructive scanning, which is a lot less expensive, where you saw off the binding of the book and put it through a sheet-fed scanner, like a Xerox machine, that would then put it through and image the images of the pages. Of course, nobody wants to do this to books. So in general, we hold the book upright at a 90-degree angle and then use digital cameras to take pictures of the pages. And those images then are put in the computer, and the computer then can be used to take those pages and do optical character recognition to be able to find the words and phrases on those pages so that those can be used for indexing. So after one goes and takes all these images, weaves it back together, maybe into a PDF file or a DJVU file, then those images would then get bound into a document, but if you searched with a word, it would pull up the pages that have those words on them, and you can then look at the images of the pages. So it's even better in some sense than our current libraries, where we're having to use the card catalog to find the book. We can look inside the book. Of course, it's not going to really replace all uses of books. It's wonderful to hold them in your hands. And some people can even go and download and print and bind these books. Then that's one of the wonders of the public domain. So the process is to go from a book that's on a shelf, figure out whether it's been scanned before, whether it's under copyright, or whether you want to go and scan it, put it in one of these scanning stations, either the robotic ones, Kirtas and there's others, or in a manual system to image the pages, put them online, process them such that they're in as good form for viewing online and for searching, and also allowing downloading, printing, and binding.
We're talking with Brewster Kahle, founder of the Internet Archive. If you'd like to join the discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. Let's take a call now from Robert in California. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Well, I have a question, now I have another question after hearing the explanation. The question about that is that it sounds like you're saying that what someone will be seeing on the Internet would be not just text, but actual an image of the page of the book. Is that correct?
Yes. Usually, it's much easier to just put the image of the page up on the screen, so that it's true to the original as we can. There's different debates of whether you want to go and make them black and white, or do you want to actually use color to get the full effect of the yellowing of the pages. And those debates will go back and forth. But in general, you look at the images of the pages, and you search on the text. There's some people that go the extra mile to try to correct the text so that you could go and cut and paste it into a paper and know that all of the punctuation is correct. But that's an expensive process, and so in general it's done with just the images.
Okay, my original question was if people are thinking about the importance of making sure that actual physical libraries are not replaced by the Internet because it's digital and because it's vulnerable to be, you know, in different governments and different places with different administrations, you know, things could be banned or shut down or manipulated if information only exists digitally and there are no physical libraries to go to.
Do you think this is... Thanks so much for your call, Robert. And,
you're welcome.
Is this the end of physical libraries or the beginning of the end of physical libraries?
The shape of libraries is in the process of changing, and we as a society get to figure out what it is we want. And we now have a commercial player playing a big role with a big, big budget. But the caller brought up some very good points. There's some things about physical libraries that we should just never lose touch with. One is the place, the trusted place that one can come together and meet and be in an environment to discuss and debate things in a free and open environment. The public library system is wonderful for that. Another aspect that the caller brought up that I thought is very important is to have multiple copies in multiple places. The tragedy of the Library of Alexandria, the center of learning in the ancient world, is in fact best known now for burning by not being here. So what do we learn from this? And one is to just not have one copy. So to have these in multiple repositories in multiple places is essential. And we've got to grow into this, though it's not easy. So Michael Keller mentioned visiting the Bibliothèque Alexandrina. That's the new incarnation of the Library of Alexandria. It's a fantastic resource. It's actually a partner with the Internet Archive, where they're digitizing their Arabic books, and they're giving copies of those to the Internet Archive, as well as the European Archive in Europe. And in trade, the Internet Archive is trading all of its materials with the Egypt. And this is also now going on with the Million Books Project in China and in India. So these large-scale swaps are going on in some projects, but not in others. And I hope that this idea of having large archives that contain copies of what's in the other archives catches on, so that when Google goes and does a large-scale scanning, it doesn't just end up with Google and maybe just with Stanford, but Stanford would feel free to share those wonderful resources with others.
Most of the effort to digitize information for the web is text-based, but what about sound and audio archives? Paul Gerhardt is joint director of the BBC Creative Archive, and he joins us now from his home in Oxford, England. Thanks for being with us.
Hello.
What are some of the issues that come up with putting sound and audio on the web that are different from when you're working with text?
Well, I just managed to catch the last few minutes of what Bruce has been talking about, and I think although there are some different technical issues, essentially the approach is very similar to the one that Bruce has described, because living in the age that we do, in the media-saturated age that we live in, for many people, audio-visual images and TV programs are as powerful instruments for learning, for expressing yourself, for discovering new ideas, as books. So we're very interested in finding ways in which the BBC's programs that have inspired many people when they have been broadcast are also going to be available for people to refer back to review, to see again, and even to build new creative ideas on the basis of them. We have the technology of sharing audiovisual images on the web, and of course, the recent concern by Hollywood and the major studios about the piracy of movie films shows that there is an enormous amount of file sharing going on already. The issue for us is how we can create a legal, accessible quantity of material that people can enjoy and know that they are fully within their rights to access.
And how will people, what will be needed in order to access an audio-visual archive that's different?
Well, we are assuming that that most of our users, when we get going, and we're only at the very, very beginnings of this project, but when we get going with our pilot service next year, our users, we expect in the UK to have a high-speed connection, and will come to the BBC's very large website, which is mainly at the moment a website based around text and pictures. And they will find on that website opportunities to download both clips from our programs and whole programs through this pilot phase.
Do you have to digitize in real time?
Yeah, we have to digitize, but we're very lucky because, of course, unlike a library, the BBC is a major broadcasting institution which is constantly digitizing and modernizing both its production process and the assets that it has. So the digitization process, although it does cost, it is part of our budget, nevertheless is sitting on top of a constant process of modernization of how we collect our material, how we edit, and how we distribute it for digital television and for web distribution.
Now, do you have any rights issues here? We were talking earlier about the copyright issues that some may come up in terms of digitizing libraries. You're working with the BBC for a BBC archive, so does that come up at all, the whole rights issue?
Well, it certainly does come up because although the BBC fully owns a large part of its archive, or at least significant parts of its television programs and radio programs, nevertheless, embedded within that material are the rights of many other artists, writers, and providers of material. So what we have to do is to think about winning the involvement of those other rights holders and stakeholders so that they too can recognize the public value of making this archive more accessible. At the same time, we need to reassure them. We need to reassure them that we are going to allow this material to be downloaded not at broadcast quality. It'll be a good quality for viewing on your PC, but it won't be broadcast quality, and therefore it won't be possible for the material to be immediately pirated and reused in another broadcast setting. So we're taking steps to reassure other rights holders, and we're inviting them to participate in the pilot so that they too can understand the benefits of a greater public access to the content.
We're talking about what's on the net and what's not, and the number to call is 1-800-989-8255, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take a call now. We're going to go to John in Medford, Oregon. Hi, John.
Hi. I have two quick questions. One is, I've always been surprised how you can type anything into a search engine on the Internet, and you'll get thousands of web pages, a lot of which are complete nonsense. The Internet contains a lot of misinformation. And presumably a librarian at a physical library could help pick and choose what books sit on the shelves and that are accurate to a specific subject. So my first question is, who would presumably control the quality of the information in a digital library? And my second question is quickly, there has for some time been concern about grammar on the Internet and how a grammar has been changing due to the lack of use of it on the Internet. How do you think this digital library will affect a subject like that?
All right. Thanks for your questions, John. I'm going to ask Brewster Kahle to respond. Brewster?
Yes, the librarian community, and we librarians think of sort of a couple of our major values that we bring is selection, of trying to select good things, and cataloging it so that people know what it is they're looking at. These are values and traditions are radically shifting given the internet, where selection is often done automatically through these search engines, where you're having broad access, as you put out, and some of it's good and some of it's bad. And even if it was published in a book 100 years ago, you'd sort of think, well, gosh, it must have been right. But even then, things weren't published that were not necessarily the authoritative versions. So I don't think that we're going to have to get any substitute from just educating ourselves and know where books came from, who said what about it, being a more critical media viewer, better reader, and the tools that we've got at our disposal are largely automatic, which sometimes help and sometimes hurt. The people who bought this one bought that one, but it doesn't really mean that those are particularly good.
Paul Gerhardt, let me ask you about this cataloging. How do you catalog the audiovisual material?
Well, this is always a big challenge, and it's one that we're already facing internally in the BBC, because many program makers use our archive to select shots and material to create new material. So we are already addressing that by trying to decide what kind of metadata to attach to the programs that we create, and we archive. Secondly, I think there's another point to make here, which is that the web is a wonderful tool where we can enlist the help of many people, particularly those who want to use programs and use audiovisual material, to help us to describe the content in new ways, which will become useful for other groups as well. So the process of identifying the component parts and accurately describing them and making them retrievable is an ongoing process, and we want to enlist the full involvement of our users as well as to do it ourselves.
Paul Gerhardt, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Paul Gerhardt is the joint director of the BBC Creative Archive. He joined us from his home in Oxford, England. When we come back from a short break, we will continue talking about what is and what is not available on the Internet. We'll be joined by Brewster Kahle, founder of the Internet Archive. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Today we're talking about the virtual library and what you can and can't find on it. Our guest is Brewster Kahle, founder of the Internet Archive. How would you use all this great new accessed information? Join the conversation. Call us at 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. We're going to take a call now from Made in Wisconsin. Hi, Made.
Yes, good afternoon. I was very excited to hear of the Google project and of this one, of course, too. I'm involved in a project where we're translating Balinese manuscripts, Lontar manuscripts, from the old Kawi into Bahasa Indonesia, the modern Indonesian language, and I'm on the end of translating into English. I've spoken with the people in Bali at Udaya University, and they would be very happy to have this added. And if someone would like to give me a website that I can send some information to, I'd prefer not to give it over the air. But I have some very in-depth information and some contacts if they would be interested in including this in the archives.
Brewster Kahle?
I think we'd be interested in all these materials. I've visited the largest Lontar, those palm leaf books where they scratch the letters in Bali. That wonderful library in the north part of the island is a fantastic
library,
resource.
Yeah.
And having much more availability to those wonderful stories, I think, is going to be in many ways like the biodiversity of the world will start to be shown by the libraries of Bali, of all sorts of places, of Groton, Connecticut, that are where the people's lives and stories are living. And so bringing those to light so that people can enjoy them, whether they're related or not related, it would be fantastic. What we have at our availability now is less expensive digitization and distribution, and we welcome all comers.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Made.
And thank you.
Let's also take a call now from Mike in Ithaca, New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Lynn. Hi, Bruce. I've got a lot to say, so I'm going to try to be fast.
Okay.
First of all, if you can give me contact information, or I'll try to find it later, I know where there's a great source on Internet stuff and hieroglyphics. But what I really want to talk about is I have both hearing impaired and visually impaired. And I also have the problem that the people in the local libraries where I live can't believe my handicap can be that bad. So they never give me quite what I ask for and always less what I ask for. And they do it under protest because they think I can do it myself. And they think I can find it on the Internet. But I'm absolutely unable to use Windows. I can use DOS. And I can access anything on the Internet that's a text file. But anything that's a PDF is a disaster. And when they're cached copies of the PDF files available so one can read them as if they were text files, I can't search them. The software I have to search them without downloading them first means I have to listen to 200 words being read and to tell in a menu to, and then pick a word, and I have to listen to all that, and it puts me to sleep. If I download it first, I can search it in seconds. And if this material is put up without putting it as text files, as PDF files, I'm simply going to be left out.
Oh, interesting point. Let me ask Brewster Kahle to respond to that. Are these kinds of concerns being taken into consideration with all of this going on?
I don't know what Google is doing with this. There are certain restrictions that often the commercial players are putting on materials to try to protect their investments, if you will, so that they can't be downloaded by their competitors. But at least the open access text archives and the libraries that are committed to these are making these materials available in multiple different ways. And you brought up a bunch of different ones. And so let me just list off a few. One is to have these available through image formats for those that can deal with them. The optical character recognition, while it's often faulty, it has errors in it, is available as text files as well. And interestingly, there's even the offline. How do we do things that when you don't want to be looking at a computer? I don't want to be reading books on computers. Maybe it's just my age, but I'd rather be reading a book, turning pages. So making it easy to print and bind books is also one of the fabulous options that we now have. So that every library in the world could be a million book library. Or if you walk to an internet cafe in some remote place, you could walk away with a book. And it's just as easy to make a large print edition as it is to make a normal print edition. So this digitization could actually increase access to those that have particular desires or requirements for different types of access.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us today, Brewster Kahle.
Thank you.
Brewster Kahle is founder of the Internet Archive, a nonprofit digital library. He joined us from member station KALW in San Francisco, California.